You can't fully understand the moment we're living in without knowing where we've been. On every episode of NPR's Throughline, we take a story from the news and go back in time to where it started, where it really started. To answer one important question, how did we get here? Find NPR's Throughline on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
More Than a Movie is back with Season 2. I'm your host, Alex Fumero. And each week, I'm going to talk to the people behind your favorite movies. From The Godfather, Andy Garcia.
He has the smarts of Vito, the temper of Sonny, the warmth of Fredo, and the coldness of Michael.
To the legend behind La Bamba, Lou Diamond Phillips.
When I walked in, I didn't think I had a shot at Richie because John Stamos's picture was already up on the wall.
Listen to More Than a Movie on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
MTV's official Challenge podcast is back for another season.
And so are we.
I'm Tori Deal.
And I'm Anissa Ferreira.
The wait is over, guys. All Stars 4 is finally here.
And this season takes it to a whole new level. Old school legends, modern power players, and ex-lovers are all competing in Cape Town, South Africa for the prize of $300,000.
And we're going to be right here along with you fans, covering every episode on the podcast.
Listen to MTV's official Challenge podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Countdown with Keith Olbermann is a production of iHeartRadio. Joe Biden has still won the debt deal, but now there is also the chance that not only will Kevin McCarthy lose it, but so will Joe Manchin. In page 95 of the agreement, that's 95 out of 99, that putrid, unreliable, self-aggrandizing, self-inflating, fraudulent sheep in sheep's clothing, Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia has managed to stick the permitting legislation for his favorite project to accelerate the end of life on the planet from catastrophic climate change, the good old Mountain Valley Natural Gas Pipeline. And Senator Tim Kaine of Virginia is planning to remove the good old Mountain Valley Pipeline from page 95 and from the deal, come hell or high water. Senator Kaine has always been opposed to this 300-mile-long living monument to environmental disasters, both short-term and long-term, and he makes the unanswerable argument that it is, quote, completely unrelated to the debt ceiling matter. And, of course, it is completely unrelated to it, and Kaine will file an amendment now to get it cut the hell out of the bill. Because if President Biden would like to piss away the goodwill of having averted a default that never should have been in play, but Democrats in the House slept through the lame duck, and Democrats in the White House apparently did not know about the 14th Amendment a couple of weeks ago, and if President Biden would like to piss away the triumph of his victory over McCarthy, and if President Biden would like to piss away the early signs of a significant poll bump here, Biden 46-44 in the Echelon Insights national poll, Biden 47-43 in the Clarity national poll just out last night. If President Biden would like to piss away all that, the way to do it is to umbrella this albatross of the Joe Manchin's Integrity Memorial Pipeline into the debt deal. It doesn't have a damn thing to do with the debt deal, other than to lubricate Joe Manchin and make the Democrats and Biden and Chuck Schumer think, ooh, now Manchin will owe us something, except he never thinks that way, and he never repays the favor, and his voting record actually suggests he may be more worthless than cinema, and trust me, I know how worthless cinema is. The Joe Manchin burn the atmosphere Mountain Valley Pipeline is the fossil fuel world's raised middle finger to the Democrats and the green energy universe, and for that matter, to reality. It is a reminder that people like Joe Manchin will really try to sell the last living humans on the planet one more cubic foot of natural gas before they die. Mr. President, you want to put something in here for the fossil fuel industry? How about you write a guarantee that you will not nationalize it? That when those parts of it that cannot figure out how to convert their businesses into ones that sell products that don't destroy life on the planet, slowly, After utter destabilization of society and uncontrollable waves of disease and starvation and violence, that maybe the government can buy their destructive companies instead, because God forbid murderers like the people who own Joe Manchin don't get to keep their profits high enough. And I made a verb out of umbrella there because it is a bleak, grammatical, shorthand joke from inside my own family. I knew it from my grandmother, my mother's mother, who used to say after a series of demands on her that would lead to yet one more worse demand, quote, "Don't umbrella me," or just umbrella. Umbrella means, I suppose I can handle you shoving the umbrella up my posterior. Just don't open it. The Schlumbohm and Charbonnier families were not exactly the epitome of delicacy in the Bronx a century ago, but even they cleaned it up to just the one word. So, umbrella, Mr. President. I get it. You're not going to do as much as you have said about climate, but the other party is insane and we do not have much choice. Just don't umbrella us. Take the Joe Manchin gold-plated with corruption Mountain Valley Pipeline out of the debt deal and give it to Senator Manchin and tell him to put it, just give it to him and say to him, umbrella. I'm not going to let go of the pipeline thing and Manchin, but I am going to continue to give Biden props on the win. If the pipeline remains, we will have to revisit that. In the interim, I am also going to give him props on the humble brag tightrope he successfully maneuvered. A little tough to hear him here, as usual, with the helicopter at the White House, but he is essentially boasting that he hasn't boasted while reminding you that you would boast and thus you'd lose, but he would never boast about that either.
I spoke to McConnell. I spoke to a whole bunch of people, and it feels good. We'll see when the vote starts. And look, one of the things that I hear some of you guys saying is, why didn't Biden say what a good deal it is? Why would Biden be saying what a good deal is before the vote? You think that's going to help me get it passed? No. That's why you guys don't bargain very well.
The Republicans, who can't bargain either, judging by McCarthy, are, of course, having one more knockdown drag out in the Rules Committee over the debt deal, and it's so Republican, it's hilarious. You may recall that as part of his 17 different deals with 17 different devils to get the speakership, Kevin McCarthy had to put the worst of MAGA, like Ralph Norman and this nut Thomas Massey and this moron Chip Roy, on the Rules Committee. Well, now Chip Roy insists that not only did McCarthy agree to put the maggots on rules, he also made a double secret handshake agreement that all nine Republicans on that panel have to agree before any legislation advances from their Rules Committee to the full House. So while Roy was attacking McCarthy with that, another Republican on the Rules Committee, Dusty Johnson, was attacking Roy. Quote, I have not heard that before. If those conversations took place, the rest of the conference was unaware of them, and frankly, I doubt them. So Dusty is, with a kind of civility that is startling in a 21st century Republican, Dusty is calling Chip a liar. Incidentally, Congressman Dusty, Congressman Chip, what is this, ZZ Top? Well, by the way, the success in succession of Tom Wamscans has nothing to do with one of the great one-moment immortals in baseball history, Bill Wamscans. Well, you have to have seen this yesterday or earlier. An expert at a baby names website tweeted it last Wednesday. And in fact, the urban legend about baseball and the TV series turns out to go back at least 2 years, and it was in the New York Times. The idea is that the success in the, well, let's call it a nighttime soap opera, of Tom Wamscans, W-A-M-B-S-G-A-N-S, was forecast in succession by his name, that everybody should have been able to figure out that he would prevail in the succession in succession because he more or less shared his name with Bill Wamscans, W-A-M-B-S-G-A-N-S-S. Bill Wamscance, or Bill Wamscance, as he was often known too, was the second baseman of the then Cleveland Indians from 1914 through 1923. He was a really good, rangy infielder who was pretty fast and hit .259 lifetime, but in a time of sluggers, didn't. Wamscance was a lot to say back then or fit into a box score in 1920, so Bill answered to Wamby or Wamby. But in the fifth inning of Game 5 of the 1920 World Series, he became a baseball immortal. The Brooklyn Robins, now the LA Dodgers, the National League champions that year, put two men on with nobody out. With the runners moving, Brooklyn's Clarence Mitchell hit a sharp line drive to Wamscance for one out. Then Wamscance took a couple of strides and stepped on second, thereby doubling off the runner on second, Pete Kilduff, who was already halfway to third base. Two out. Wamscance now said he looked up to find the Brooklyn runner from first, Otto Miller, just a few feet away from him, frozen in horror at what was happening. Bill Wamscance went over and tagged him for not just a triple play, but an unassisted triple play, the first in World Series history and the last. And it's been 103 years, and it was only the second or third in all of baseball history at that point, depending on how you interpret baseball history. Even now, there have only been 15 or 16 unassisted triple plays, and incidentally, six of them were either by or against Cleveland, which is statistically really unlikely. And two of them happened on consecutive days in 1927, which is even crazier. But the point is, Wamscance defeated three rivals all by himself all at once. Got it? Just like the Wamscance in succession? Huh? Huh? Pretty good, huh? And if you were paying attention, you also noticed that in the very first episode of Succession, Tom Wamscance played in the Roy family softball game, and he tagged out a kid at home plate. Good. Except it's a coincidence. Yep, it's a coincidence. Instead of just saying like everybody else did, it's an obscure baseball reference. Umbrella. Stefan Fatsis of Slate contacted the longtime New York Times columnist Frank Rich, who was one of the executive producers of the show, about this. And Rich replied, quote, "I hate to spoil the internet's fun, but it's false. Tom's family name was picked before we had shot a first season, let alone mapped out precise story twists that would culminate 39 episodes later. Not to mention that many of the key writers on the show, starting with its creator Jesse Armstrong, are British, live in London, and are devoted to British football. If memory serves," Frank Rich continued, "we were looking for something off-key that would be awkward to say and pronounce, befitting a character who arrives as an outsider in the Roy's world," unquote. So, sorry, conspiracy fans. And anyway, if you had a triple play accomplishing character in Succession named after Bill Wamscance, you'd really also have to have had one named after triple play hitting into batter Clarence Mitchell, because as remarkable as Wamscance's unassisted triple play was in the 1920 World Series, I have always thought, as a baseball historian, that what Clarence Mitchell did was far more remarkable, because the next time Clarence Mitchell came up in the same game in the eighth inning after having just hit into a triple play, Clarence Mitchell promptly then hit into a double play. He made five outs with two swings. Well, maybe they can make that the plot line in the sequel. And you know there's going to be a sequel. Also of note today, the Russians have put out an arrest warrant for Lindsey Graham over what he said about Russians dying in Ukraine and money well spent. And ordinarily I'd be conflicted because it's Lindsey Umbrella Graham. But more importantly, it's the Russians. And after the day-long bombing of civilian targets in Kyiv yesterday and the increasing threats of using tactical nukes, their terrorism in Ukraine has to stop, and we have to stop not just dealing with them, but dealing with any other country that still deals with Russia. Okay, so now I'm going to go fire up the Wayback Machine again. That's next. This is Countdown. So the best way to get what you need is to be prepared and to do it early, like World Series tickets. My dad had the foolproof plan for getting us World Series tickets behind the home dugout in 1976, 77, 78. He bought season tickets in the Bronx in 1972. When you want the best, you have to act quickly, or someone else will get it instead. It's like if you're hiring for your business. You want to find the most talented people for your open roles before the competition scoops them up. So what's the best way to do that? ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. And right now you can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/countdown. ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology hits the front row to identify top talent for your roles. Immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. Amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/countdown to try it for free. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/countdown. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
You can't fully understand the moment we're living in without knowing where we've been. On every episode of NPR's Throughline, we take a story from the news and go back in time to where it started, where it really started. To answer one important question, how did we get here? Find NPR's Throughline on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm preaching to somebody today who is waiting for God to give you your next step. And you don't know what it is yet. You need God to show you your next step. Because God, I can't stay where I am like I am where it is. This isn't going to work. I have to move on, but I don't know where. A lot of time you'll use it as an excuse. Well, I don't know how. I don't know where. I don't know what. God, if you show me. God, if you tell me. God, if no. You know enough right now. And if you needed to know more, he would show you.
Hey, this is Stephen Furtick. I want to invite you to listen to my podcast, Elevation with Stephen Furtick. I am here to help you for the battles that you face in life, for the times when you feel discouraged, for the times that you need guidance from God. I want to give you the truth of what he says about you to help you rise to your full potential. Listen to Elevation with Stephen Furtick every Sunday and Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Countdown with Keith Olbermann.
Postscripts to the news, some updates, some snark, some complete redefinition of the premise. Because this is about as postscripty as you can get. But the response was so enthusiastic and so surprising to yesterday's concluding segments in which I dived into the big plastic banker's box in my closet full of ancient brittle audio cassettes and played stuff that had not been heard by anybody else besides me since 1987. Actually, some of them were from 1979. Anyway, the response has implied that maybe during slow news or my semi-vacation days, and I mean like a couple of them a year, or at worst a month, I'm not doing this every week, it's worth reprising some of this old stuff and some of the amazing stories from my radio career which accompany them. The first thing you will hear today is from my stint as the backup sportscaster at WNEW Radio in New York. This was a legendary place when I got there in 1980, the last of the big New York City stations to broadcast from a literal ballroom with giant studios, 2 stories tall, and drapes and room for studio audiences. They had moved out of there by then. That was on Fifth Avenue. They played big band music, and their disc jockeys were legends who had succeeded other legends. Everybody from Gene Rayburn, later of Match Game, to Boris Karloff. Boris Karloff was a WNEW disc jockey in the 1950s.
No, here's Elvis Presley.
The newscasters were legends, too. If you've ever seen the film of Lee Harvey Oswald being shot, the guy in the hat and the overcoat sticking out his microphone and trying to interview Oswald as Jack Ruby puts his gun out next to the guy, that man in the hat with the microphone is Ike Pappas of WNEW Radio in New York. That's how big a news department they had.
And one day, WNEW took its boutique FM station, which just was a clearer version of its AM station, and they turned it into the greatest place in the history of rock and roll radio. And when I got there in 1980, WNEW broadcast the play-by-play of the New York Giants, the New York Rangers, the New York Knicks, the New York Cosmos. And I got to work there because they were an affiliate of the radio network run by United Press International, UPI Audio, my first employers. In retrospect, doing the night sports shift at UPI was exhausting. There was a sportscast every hour between 5:45 and 10:45. Occasionally, you had to engineer. You had to play all the carts and dial all the dials for the newscast at the top of the hour. If there was a breaking sports story, you had to try to call somebody to record a phone interview with them or get a local reporter somewhere to do an interview or file a report. Plus, if some reporter called in from an afternoon game or a night game that finished early, you had to handle, edit, and feed out the tape of player interviews. No digital editing, mind you. Actual, physical cutting and splicing. And then there was the commentary. My side. 2 minutes of sports commentary that was sent out to the 1,000 stations that paid for UPI audio. You had to get it done before your shift was over, in between all those other sportscasts and all those other things you had to do. You had to write it. Well, first you had to think about it, then you had to write it, then you had to record it, then you probably had to edit it several times together. This was something that had been started by the great UPI baseball columnist Milton Richman, whose print column was called, guess what, My Side. Milt would just read his paper copy until about a minute 55 had passed, and then he'd say, I'm Milton Richman, and that's my side, whether or not he had actually made his point by then. Anyway, Milt soon got tired of it, and knowing UPI, they probably paid him an extra $3 a year. But our stations, most of whom were among America's smallest, wanted, needed, a two-minute sports commentary to run in the mornings. Soon, my side became the side of whoever was doing the night shift at UPI Audio Sports. Me, Jack Russell, Sam Rosen, Peter Shacknow, Bruce McGowan, Mike Alabaugh, whoever. And it was traditional stuff. The Cowboys are the best team in football. Sports leagues need to figure out a way to use TV replays to get bad calls right. And, of course, how dare Cassius Clay try to change his name? I did not do that one. I usually did four or five of these commentaries a week, and I got tired of these fast. So even though I had no time to try to make them creative, I tried to make them creative. I, in fact, started to do wacky ones. I would save the tapes of the weird comments that our stringer reporters would feed in, and soon I had a running series of my sides about how often athletes used the verbal crutch, you know, in their answers. Hell, that got me written up in Sports Illustrated once, back when that was a big deal, and they paid you $50 for it, and my rent was $4.90 a month. One night, I devoted my side to a collection of weird things that hockey players said. I've mentioned here once, and the tape exists somewhere, I've got to find it, that the late legend Bobby Hull once answered my nostalgic question by saying, "Oh, that's in the past. Never mind the past. We're here in the future now." Which still freaks me out. I did one long piece about the NHL team they used to have in Quebec City, suddenly saying they would make public address announcements only in French, no English. So I took 7 years of schoolboy French and tried to provide helpful translations for English-speaking fans who got stuck at the Quebec Nordique game. Translations of such phrases as, "Do not punch me, Mr. Left Wing. I am not the fan who threw the miniature Stanley Cup at you." I'll spare you the schoolboy French. Oh, to hell with it. Je ne me frappe pas, monsieur l'allié droit. Je ne suis pas le spectateur qui lance à vous le coupe de Stanley miniature. And yes, some of the fractured French was deliberate. Some of it. Anyway, one day, when I got into work, there was a letter waiting for me in the office, and the return address was Andy Fisher, Robin Sagan, and Tom Marrera of WNEW-FM. Andy and Robin were the newscasters, and Tom was the overnight disc jockey, and they had heard one of the hockey pieces, and they enjoyed it so much that on his earliest newscast on WNEW-FM, which I think was at 4:45 in the morning, Andy gave the headlines of the day and the weather, and then, played the entire two-minute piece about the hockey players. The letter from them was lovely, and they said, look, if you ever want to come around and visit, we're just around the corner. On the other hand, Tom leaves the office at 6 a.m. Well, I took them up on it. One night, I did my UPI shift ending at 11, and instead of hopping on the train to go to my folks' home in the suburbs, I instead had a lot of coffee, and I hung around UPI, knocking off a couple of feature pieces and pre-writing a couple of more My Sides, and then in the middle of an April or early May night in the year of our Lord, 1980, I walked around the corner from UPI's office in the New York Daily News building. You know the building. You saw it if you ever saw the first Christopher Reeve Superman movie, the one in the big planet in the lobby. I did this at around 3 o'clock in the morning, took my life in my hands. They buzzed me in at WNEW on 3rd Avenue, and I met Tom, and I met Andy, and I did a commentary for them live on WNEW-FM, and then just hung out in the newsroom with Andy and the AM news guys, and I was just sitting there preparing to take the first morning train home to my folks, which was, I think, 6:40 a.m. It was about 10 after 5 when a tall, extraordinarily thin man with a bushy beard and a gleam in his eye and a hello shouted in a deep Texas accent walked in, and everybody in that newsroom said, "Hi, Sam!" And Sam looked at me funny and ducked into what was evidently his office, and then came out, walked over to me and said, "You're Olbermann, huh?" And I said, "Yes." He said, "I'm Sam Hall. I'm the news director. Want to make some per diem? My sportscaster's out sick today." And I said, "Sure. I mean, you know that phrase about right place, right time and all that. Terrific." And Sam Hall said, "Can you write fast?" And I said, "Yeah, actually I can. It's my only skill." And he laughed and I laughed. And he said, "Well, write as much as you can. Your first sportscast is at 5:35. You're on in, 8 minutes. Well, I froze for a second. I shook his hand. I found some wire copy and I started typing. I managed somehow to call my folks and get about 2 minutes of a show written, and I woke them up and I said, "I'll be on WNEW at 5:35. And then I hung up. I did the rest of that shift that morning, and by the end of it, Sam Hall had called me into his little office and said, "Listen, my guy John Kennelly misses a lot of work. His wife's not well. Could you be the backup? I mean, could you be the kind of backup we could call at 2 a.m. and you could be here by 4? I mean, I think it would work out to about $75 a day, union money." My full-time job at UPI was about $70 a day. Sam, I'll be moving into the city next month. I'll be within walking distance." He smiled. "Welcome aboard, son." The next day, I went looking for an apartment in the city within walking distance. I did not have one. I kind of exaggerated. I do not have a tape of that first hurried WNEW sportscast, but I have most of the others. So here are a few, and a few morsels from my UPI days that I mentioned, specifically stuff I did for the network from the 1980 Winter Olympics in Lake Placid, New York. I'm still cold. The old CBS mock history series was called "You Were There." This series, I think, should be called "I Was There."
"Good morning, I'm Keith Olbermann. Canalia with a goal and an assist. The Cosmos out of their slump after a 3-1 win over the Sounders last night at Cosmos, a Giant Stadium, rather. In Cincinnati, Jeff Reardon gave up a ninth-inning homer to Ken Griffey, and the Mets lost to the Reds 4-3. Mets are at Houston tonight. And at Yankee Stadium, another one of those Yankee-Royals pitchers' duels. KC 14, the Yankees 3. But manager Dick Houser isn't worried about a repeat of the past weekend if the Yanks and Royals meet in the playoffs."
"A series doesn't mean anything to me, no."
Houser will have more to say, and we'll answer the question, "How hot was it at Yankee Stadium yesterday?" on the Sports Report at about 8:35.
And that man's name is Keith Olbermann. Now, how hot was it at Yankee Stadium, Bob Harris?
"Got to figure about 110 to 112 degrees in the outfield in the noonday sun."
The news has been brought to you by Allen Carpet. I'm Bob Hagen.
And now, WNEW Sports and Commentary with John Kennelly.
And good morning. John continues on vacation. I'm Keith Olbermann. So maybe the Cosmos didn't beat Philadelphia or Detroit last week. You'd never have guessed they were in any kind of slump the way they beat league-leading Seattle last night. Despite 112-degree on-field temperatures, the Cosmos won 3-1 at Giants Stadium. Canalia with a goal and an assist to move back into first place in the scoring race. Next up for the Cosmos, Wednesday night at Giants Stadium against San Diego. The Mets are in Houston right now, resting up for their opener with the Astros tonight. John Pacella and Ken Forsch, the likely pitchers. You hope a ball game like yesterday's won't take too much out of these kids. They storm back to tie Cincinnati when Mazzilli hit his 13th homer in the eighth with Flynn on. And then Jeff Reardon gives up a game-winning homer with two out on the ninth to Ken Griffey. Joe Torre says if it had to be anybody, he's not mad that it was Griffey.
Those things happen. You know, he tried to make a pitch and he didn't quite hit the location he wanted. And you'll never be embarrassed when you're beat by a home run from Ken Griffey. You know, I mean, we saw it in the All-Star game. And, you know, I felt we were pretty fortunate to be able to tie the score. That was, you know, they didn't have more runs. We had great relief pitching, great pitching when we needed it to get out of innings. And, you know, I thought once we tied it, we were going to win it. But
then came Griffey's homer. Torrey's club now 6.5 out. The Pirates are in first after splitting a doubleheader with the Dodgers, losing the first 4-2, winning the nightcap 8-7. The Expos lost at Houston 4-3, so the Astros go back into first in the West. It was the Cards 2, San Francisco 1, the Braves over the Phillies 3-2, and Chicago topping San Diego 6-0. How hot was it at Yankee Stadium yesterday afternoon? It was so hot when Dick Houser went out to the mound to take Ron Guidry out in the second inning, he wore an asbestos suit. It was so hot after the game, I saw the Royals being poured into their team bus. It was so hot, but seriously, the Royals were what was hot yesterday. They won 14-3 as game time temperatures hit 98 degrees at the stadium. Guidry shelled for 7 in less than 2 innings, his confidence definitely shaken. How about the Yankees' confidence that they could beat the Royals in the playoffs? Dick Houser still seems pretty sure of his club.
We might have a shade more power. They might hit for a little better average, but I think our pitching is better and they have more speed. And we'll just, when we lock horns, if we do, we'll just have to see who's the best club then. But a series doesn't mean anything to me. Now, Guidry's going to pitch against them again in Kansas City, and we'll see what happens then.
Also key, what happens this week is the Brewers come to town for what could be the last important series of the Eastern race. 4 games. Brewers currently trail Yanks by 8.5. Mike Caldwell against Tom Underwood tonight. Milwaukee won yesterday 7-6 over the White Sox. It was Texas 7 and Baltimore 1. Twins over the Red Sox 5-4. Blue Jays beat the Angels 6-3 in 10. Detroit over Seattle 5-2. And Oakland stopped Cleveland 6-5. That one took 14 innings. Only 3 Americans had ever won the British Open 3 times each. They were Ben Hogan, Bobby Jones, and Jack Nicklaus. Well, you can add Tom Watson's name to that list. Watson by 4 yesterday at Muirfield to beat Lee Trevino for the title. In Jersey yesterday in the weekly light heavyweight title bout, Eddie Mustafa Muhammad, no relation to Matthew Saad Muhammad, knocked out Jerry Martin, no relation to Billy Martin. At 2:10 of the 10th round, Mustafa maintains the WBA crown in the division. That's sports for John Kennelly. I'm Keith Olbermann on the Ted Brown Show.
On WNEW.
The Rangers season ended in April. Some say it ended last October, but they're the Islander fans, so who cares what they say? Anyway, it's been 3 months since Freddie the Fog Shiro has clouded up the Big Apple, but there he was at the Garden News Conference Tuesday, the one at which Craig Patrick got the job as Director of Operations, the one at which the Ranger management structure took on all the clarity of the government of Iran. The subject was assistant coach Mike Nikoluk. The method, circular logic. The question to Shiro, what's the story with Nikoluk? Will he be back this fall?
I sent him a cablegram to Switzerland a couple days ago saying that I have accepted the fact that he wished to quit and stay out of hockey, and I haven't heard any further on the subject.
Then a reporter said Nikoluk told him he'd never resigned.
He never said resign to me, he said quit.
So, Fred, he told you he was quitting. Did he give you a letter of resignation?
No, nobody has a letter of resignation from him. I just happened to read the words in the paper one day.
Yeah, but Fred, you're Freddie Shiro, scourge of newspaper men. You've never been one to rely on some words in the paper, right?
I think we'll take a lot of things into consideration, not just one write-up.
We had better stop now before damage is done to the delicate tissues in our brains. For WNEW-FM, I'm Keith Olbermann, and while it is too early in the morning for sports, it is definitely too early in the morning for Fred Shiro. They went wild in the streets with America's gold medal in hockey, shouts of "We're number one," the singing of the national anthem, chants of "USA, USA." And after the gold was won, one fan was awfully glad he had not followed through on an idea to scalp his tickets.
I thought about it. I thought if somebody would offer me
$200 a piece for them, I would sell them, but I'm glad I didn't.
What is your reaction now with the win?
Oh, my gracious. I wouldn't have missed it for the world. See this game, you never have to see another game the rest of your life. Biggest sport upset in 20 years.
Team of destiny.
The post-game celebration spilled over from the Olympic Center area to the streets of Lake Placid, the thousands of celebrants showing no ill effects of having done this twice in 3 days. Keith Olbermann, Lake Placid. Stunning the packed Olympic Center crowd, the favorite American team of Ty Babylonia and Randy Gardner have withdrawn from the pair's figure skating competition due to injury. Gardner had been receiving treatment for a muscle pull in his groin all day. He fell twice during the warm-ups before the start of the event, and after testing his injury briefly on ice, he and Babylonia skated off. Shortly after, a representative of the U.S. team walked cross-ice to the referee to announce the withdrawal. And so, the current defending world champions are out of the Olympic pairs competition. Years of practice and patience coming to naught for Ty Babylonia and Randy Gardner. Keith Olbermann at the Olympic Center.
Joy turned to sadness in a matter of minutes for the United States on Friday after winning two medals, a silver and a gold, and doing surprisingly well in the men's two-man bobsled. U.S. hopes for a gold medal in the pairs figure skating competition were shattered when the team of Randy Gardner and Ty Babylonia had to withdraw. Keith Olbermann was at the Olympic Center when the announcement of the withdrawal was made.
First hint came during the warm-ups before the pairs competition began. Randy Gardner fell twice, and after he and Ty Babylonia came on ice before their skating turn, Gardner determined he could not perform, and the pair withdrew due to injury. Gardner had been receiving treatment all day for a muscle pull in his groin. The news of the withdrawal shocked a packed house at the Olympic Center and left the Americans without a strong pair of candidates for a medal.
Coach John Nick said there was no way Gardner could skate.
He missed three things.
Imagine, if you will, being transported to another planet. On this planet, which is very similar to our own, you are not allowed to drive a car, but there is nothing within walking distance, no matter where you are. On this planet, there are a million things you must find out immediately, and there are a million people authorized to tell you. Yet when you ask one of them, they always say, "I don't know." On this strange planet, everyone wears heavy and sometimes absurd clothing, but the natives say it's almost like summer. Got the picture? Well, this is the culture shock hundreds of reporters and thousands of fans are going through right now. Welcome to Lake Placid for the 1980 Winter Olympics. I speak to you from the bleachers next to the skating rink that the Haydns and the Muellers will use in a couple of days, and I speak of a remarkable event called the Winter Games, an experience unto itself that almost defies description. Again, I ask you to do a little imagining. See the high school in your town, or better still, the town of your youth. Imagine it shut down suddenly and changed overnight into three floors of sheer madness as the representatives of newspapers, magazines, and radio and television companies from around the world take over everything from the gym to the chemistry lab. Some strange things happen here. You are standing next to a press representative of the Olympic Committee when he receives an important note from an assistant. "Call your wife at once," it reads. The press representative looks at you with a dumbfounded stare and says, "But I'm not married." Reporters looking to see the trial runs on Whiteface Mountain are sent halfway up the slope on a ski lift, and then they must tumble, walk, slide, and shiver halfway down again to the finish line. At every turn, somebody asks you for a pin. A pin, you say? You know, somebody's official Olympic pin. There was this girl who got on one of the press buses with a hat literally covered with pins. Team pins, sports pins, sporting good manufacturers pins, press pins. The pin appears to be as important to the average reporter or fan as the results of the women's giant slalom. Officials charged with letting authorized persons in and with keeping unauthorized persons out sometimes miss their duty while negotiating the trade of a Polish hockey pin for the pin of a German news agency. This is a weird planet, this Lake Placid, and it's only just started. Who knows what pin will turn up next? I'm Keith Olbermann, and from Lake Placid, that's my side.
You can't fully understand the moment we're living in without knowing where we've been. On every episode of NPR's Throughline, we take a story from the news and go back in time to where it started, where it really started. To answer one important question, how did we get here? Find NPR's Throughline on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm preaching to somebody today who is waiting for God to give you your next step. And you don't know what it is yet. You need God to show you your next step. Because God, I can't stay where I am, like I am, where it is. This isn't going to work. I have to move on, but I don't know where. A lot of time you'll use it as an excuse. Well, I don't know how. I don't know where. I don't know what. God, if you show me. God, if you tell me. God, if... No. You know enough right now. And if you needed to know more, he would show you.
Hey, this is Stephen Furtick. I want to invite you to listen to my podcast, Elevation with Stephen Furtick. I am here to help you for the battles that you face in life, for the times when you feel discouraged, for the times that you need guidance from God. I want to give you the truth of what he says about you to help you rise to your full potential. Listen to Elevation with Stephen Furtick every Sunday and Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I am the ferryman.
In the shadows of the afterlife, the ferryman of souls guides America's most influential spirits to their eternal rest.
Where are you taking me?
Are you death?
This road is not on any map.
How much for a ticket?
All I ask for in payment is a tale.
I don't know who got to Kennedy first.
And the devastation those first bombs caused.
I've never been to hell, but I know intimately the hymns of the damned.
All 12 episodes of The Passage are available now.
Listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
So as a reminder, let me close this time with where this thing started. As I said before, the great thing about podcasts is the metrics. I do not have to just believe that the TV ratings are correct, that they really are accurate extrapolations from, 2,000 selected viewers across the country who are supposed to represent every possible person composed of every possible demographic, and everybody in every one demographic watches the same thing. I just go to this website, and there it is, the record of everybody who listened to this, not by name, but just how many of them actually downloaded each episode. And the growth of this podcast indicates that around half of all of today's regular listeners did not hear the first edition when we published it at 3 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time on August 1, 2022, after a weekend in which I actually learned how to use the equipment, even though the laptop I was using it on crashed and burned 33 hours before posting. So this, from August 1st, episode 1, is a little wacky of a way to start, but I think it's still kind of on point.
I don't have to tell you things are bad. Everybody knows things are bad. It's a recession. Everybody goes to work, but they're still scared of losing their job. The corporations make sure the dollar buys a nickel's worth. Banks are making record profits. Teachers are told to keep a gun under the desk. Punks are running wild in Congress, and there's nobody anywhere seems to know what to do, and there's no end to it. We know the air is unfit to breathe, and our planet will be unfit for life. And we sit watching our TVs while some Fox newscaster tells us that today Trump is the real victim and minorities are the real problem, as if that's the way it's supposed to be. We all know things are bad. Worse than bad. They're crazy. It's like everything everywhere is going crazy, so we don't go out anymore. We have the Senate and the House, but slowly the democracy we're living in is getting smaller, and all we say is, please, at least leave us alone in our living rooms. Let me have my president and my RBG shrine and my January 6th hearings, and I won't say anything. Just leave us alone. Well, I'm not going to leave you alone. I want you to get mad. I want you to protest. I want you to strike. I want you to write to your congressman, because you don't need me to tell you what to write. You know what to do about the recession and the inflation and the Russians and the Nazis in the street. All I know is, first, you've got to get mad. You've got to say, I'm a human being, God damn it. My life has value. So, I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up and out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take Trump anymore. I want you to get up right now. Get up, go to your windows, open them, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell and I'm not going to take Trump anymore. Things have got to change, but first, you've got to get mad. You've got to say, I'm as mad as hell and I'm not going to take Trump anymore. Then we'll figure out what to do about the recession and the inflation and the oil cartels. But first, get up out of your chairs, open your window, stick your head out and yell and say it, I'm as mad as hell and I'm not going to take Trump anymore.
I'm mad as hell. I'm not going to take Trump anymore.
I am mad as hell, and I'm not going to take Trump anymore.
I'm mad as hell. Not going to take Trump anymore.
Sorry. Couldn't resist. And for the first time in my life, even through the brutal years of Reagan and even through the psychotic years of Bush, that famous Howard Beale speech from the 1976 movie Network seems to fit this moment. With some revisions, of course. The Beale character, as portrayed by Peter Finch, and especially that speech, and especially that catchphrase, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore, spoke to, long before it became a cliche, this weird overlap between somebody who is so enraged that he is angry mad as hell, and somebody who may be so insane that he is crazy mad as hell. But there's also a third subtext to it, which only occasionally gets mentioned and only occasionally gets appreciated, and it is why Beale and mad as hell mean something today. It's that line towards the start. We all know things are bad. Worse than bad, they're crazy. It's like everything everywhere is going crazy. In short, it's like Howard Beale, representing all of us, is going crazy because nobody else is when they should be. If in school, you had read that 100 years ago or 150 years ago or whenever a president of the United States fraudulently denied he lost the election and tried to overturn it in the courts and in the Congress, and it didn't work because it was one big lie. So he invited gangs of thugs and racists and gun suckers and militias to come to the Capitol during the most boasted about part of American democracy, the peaceful transfer of power. And having invited them, he then incited them to try to overthrow the government by violence. You would have expected to then have read about the police and the military and the laws that stopped him, and the arrests and the indictments and the lifetimes in prison and the vengeance that followed. Hell, what precipitated the Civil War, if not 11 states trying to stop the peaceful transfer of power because they didn't like who got elected? We are supposed to do something about this. When a large minority of Americans stood up and said, only whites are real people, and when they said, we will use the police to lynch black people, and when they said, guns settle everything, and when they said, women are here only to breed, and when they said, we own the Supreme Court now, and when they said, we will not teach history because we don't want children to know there's a more righteous way, and when they said, this is our world, and you, the majority, your votes do not count here, your cities do not count here, your lives do not count here, your president does not count here. When all that happened, within 39 days, our anger and our vengeance, democracy's anger and vengeance, began. It was 1861. But first, you've got to get mad. Today, they have Trump and Schedule F and a plan to impeach Biden for whatever. And they've already turned the Supreme Court into the theocratic Republican Supreme Religious Court. And they've overturned abortion, and next will be marriage equality, and they intend to investigate the January 6th committee members and pardon everybody who actually attacked the Capitol, even though you and I grew up presuming, you know, if I attacked the Capitol during the peaceful transfer of power, I'm going to guess they'll give me about 5 seconds to stop before they start shooting at me. And they want to put Fauci in prison, and they're passing laws prosecuting doctors and prosecuting women who leave a state to go to another state for an abortion. In other words, they want to prosecute women who leave a slave state to go to a free state and bring them back to the slave state. And they have a Fox News, and another worse Fox News, and another worser even than that Fox News. And what do we have? We have, once a week, somebody who says, we must find a compromise with them.
We must be bipartisan. We must be Democrats and liberals who act like Republicans and fascists and Nazis. We have Joe Manchin. And for 18 months, Joe Manchin has obstructed all the good Joe Biden has tried to do and prevented all the emergency measures we must have to keep the last words by the last human surviving the climate catastrophe on this planet from being, as chairman of Exxon Mobil, I want to report record profits for the year 2052. And when the bribe for Joe Manchin, the senator from Fossil Fuel Gulch, West Virginia, is finally sufficient to his liking and he finally agrees with Chuck Schumer on the $740 billion climate and deficit reduction bill, what does he get? He gets to go on all five network Sunday political television nitwit shows. The proverbial full Ginsburg. Glory, glory, hallelujah, it's Joe Manchin, our lawgiver, the true Democrat. And yet, Kyrsten Sinema could still kill the thing today, and Joe Manchin would then still look reasonable by contrast tomorrow. He'd still be the hero who achieved nothing. And if all that cinema stuff bothers you, I used to go out with her. We all know things are bad, worse than bad. They're crazy. It's like everything everywhere is going crazy. Even the fascists who hate or fear Trump have something closer to a plan than we do. The This Town author Mark Leibovich quoted a former Republican congressman as saying, quote, "Look, we have no plan for this except sitting around hoping he dies," unquote. Which actually sounds like more of a plan than our plan. Our plan? Make sure Democrats help the craziest Trump supporters and election deniers, and it's not IQAnon, it's just QAnon nutbags, get nominated because we're confident we can beat them, right? 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 This weekend, it will be 19 months since the coup. They have plans for more coups. A coup in Washington, a coup in every state, a coup in every county. Looks like they compromised the Secret Service and it's still compromised. Looks like they compromised the Inspector General at Homeland Security. They've compromised half the cops in this country, a little less, a little more. They've compromised, as my heroes Bob Elliott and Ray Goulding once joked, everything except the Visiting Nurse Association. They have built a cult around denying the 2020 election. And if you haven't figured out what's behind that nonsense, by the way, seemingly quixotic and academic at the same time, here's the little secret. The idea about the 2020 stuff still being talked about is if El Duce gets elected in 2024, and goes back to the White House, he will somehow make somebody like, I don't know, the Supreme Court confirm that, yes, he actually won in 2020, but was denied that rightful term in the White House. So he will be given a third term in 2028, or at least allowed to run for it. In short, if 2020 was stolen from him, he's owed another term, right? That's in the Constitution, isn't it? Gee, maybe we could just, you know, skip the 2028 election outright. The fascists have all this in the works, and what do we have? We have Chuck Todd, 3 weeks ago, asking a Republican governor, quote, "What's best for the country? Do you think the country can handle prosecuting a former president?" And we have Lester Holt, 1 week ago, telling the Attorney General of the United States, quote, "Indictment of a former president and perhaps a candidate for president would arguably tear the country apart. Is that your concern?" They have Fox News. We have Fox News. Only we call it NBC. I will do this podcast every weekday morning. No holiday Mondays. Sorry, I'm getting old. It will be as best as I can do it, the podcast version of what the old TV show was. I will explain to you later in this first episode what exactly happened to the old TV show
And here's a tease. It's none of the things you've heard. And I'll have comments on the news and comments on the sports. Did you know I used to do sports? And the worst persons in the world are back. And why Trump gets a tax break for burying his wife in the golf course. But first, I want to button up this topic about getting mad as hell with two quotes and one question. Quote number one. It's General William Tecumseh Sherman, and it's meant metaphorically, so don't think I'm talking about bloodshed, because you can't do political bloodshed in this country unless you're a Republican. This was Sherman the last time Americans tried to overthrow American democracy. Quote, "War is the remedy our enemies have chosen. Other simple remedies were within their choice. You know it, and they know it. But they wanted war. And I say, let us give them all they want, not a word of argument, not a sign of let up, no cave in, till we are whipped or they are." End Sherman quote. First, you've got to get mad. What greater act of war against the United States by someone owing allegiance to the United States within the United States could there ever be than to send armed militias into the United States Capitol, than to encourage them to attack and kill members of Congress, members of the Senate, even the Vice President? What greater act of war against the United States could there be than to try to prevent by violent revolution the peaceful transfer of power in the United States? I have no complaints about the January 6th committee. I do not buy the argument that it's the Liz Cheney show, and so what if it were? Chairman Thompson and the other Democrats have been terrific. If, as I speculated months ago, they are programming to the proverbial audience of one, and it is named Merrick Garland, dandy. But I don't see exactly how they plan to end this. So what if, first, they realized, you've got to get mad. You've got to say, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take Trump anymore. What if they ended it with another quote? What if the January 6th committee ends its final hearing by simply quoting just the start of Title 18, USC, Chapter 115, Section 2381? Quote, "Whoever, owing allegiance to the United States, levies war against them or adheres to their enemies, giving them aid and comfort within the United States or elsewhere, is guilty of treason." The way this began just 213 episodes ago on August 1st of last year. Anyway, I've done all the damage I can do here. I suspect we will be back to something resembling the normal format tomorrow. Or hell, maybe not. Who knows? Who's going to tell me what to do here? Here are the credits. Most of the music arranged, produced, and performed by Brian Ray and John Philip Chanel, the Countdown musical directors. All orchestration and keyboards by John Philip Chanel, guitars, bass, and drums by Brian Ray, produced by TKO Brothers. TKO Brothers are John Philip Chanel, Brian Ray, and me. Other Beethoven selections have been arranged and performed by the group No Horns Allowed. The sports music is the Olbermann theme from ESPN2, and it was written by Mitch Warren Davis, courtesy of ESPN Inc. Musical comments by Nancy Faust, the best baseball stadium organist ever. Our announcer was my friend Larry David, and everything else was pretty much my fault. So that's Countdown for this, the 875th day since Donald Trump's first attempted coup against the democratically elected government of the United States. Don't forget to keep arresting him while we still can. The next scheduled Countdown is tomorrow. Until then, I'm Keith Olbermann. Good morning, good afternoon, good night, and good luck. Countdown with Keith Olbermann is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia, movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.
You can't fully understand the moment we're living in without knowing where we've been. On every episode of NPR's Throughline, we take a story from the news and go back in time to where it started, where it really started. To answer one important question, how did we get here? Find NPR's Throughline on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
MTV's official Challenge podcast is back for another season.
And so are we.
I'm Tori Deal.
And I'm Anissa Ferreira.
The wait is over, guys. All Stars 4 is finally here.
And this season takes it to a whole new level. Old school legends, modern power players, and ex-lovers are all competing in Cape Town, South Africa for the prize of $300,000.
And we're going to be right here along with you fans, covering every episode on the podcast.
Listen to MTV's official Challenge podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.